This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Abraham Lincoln had a passion for music, and this afternoon we're going to take a look at Lincoln and his age through the lens of music. On the program, we'll explore the music of Lincoln's time and his interest in music and the mark this music has made on our musical heritage. Two guests join me this afternoon. On the phone with us this afternoon, historian Vernon Burton, and with me in the studio, Scott Schwartz of the Center for American Music at the University of Illinois. The impetus for this interview is the Center's 2008 music celebration, the theme of which is Lincoln and His Music, Melodies That Moved the Man and the Nation. The musical celebration is a joint effort of the University of Illinois and the Champaign-Urbana community. So in addition to talking about Lincoln and his love of music, we'll also have some information for you about events planned for this year's music celebration. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number to join our discussion in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guests. Vernon Burton is the author or editor of 10 books. He is distinguished teacher, scholar, emeritus at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's director of the Institute for Computing in Humanities, Arts, and Social Science, where he is associate director for the Humanities and Social Sciences at the National Center for Supercomputing. His most recent book, The Age of Lincoln, was published in 2007 by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and is now in paperback through Hill and Wang. And Scott Schwartz, he's the archivist for music and fine arts at the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And Vernon Burton, by the way, will be taking part in the celebration of Lincoln and his music. He will present a talk, Lincoln's America, at Alice Campbell Alumni Center on November 22nd at 10:30. We'll have more information on that as well later in the program. Again, listeners, if you'd like to join our discussion with a question, a comment, here are the numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Vernon Burton, Scott Schwartz, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks
for very much for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, first question to Scott, what did we hear there at the outset, that rousing music there?
That was the Trovatore Quick Step, played by the 26th North Carolina Regimental Band. It was written for them. It's a piece that's based on Verdi's Il Trovatore, an opera that had quite an impression on many people in America when it was first played here.
Yeah. And the next question is for Vernon Burton. By looking at this part of life in America, the musical life and the music Lincoln enjoyed, what do we learn about the man in our history? What kinds of things can we pick up on?
Oh, what a question. And I don't want to dominate, but that's at least a two-hour lecture. So much. You know, music reflects in many ways who we are and who we want to be. And that's certainly the case, besides just enjoying it. But a little bit before Lincoln, this reminds me the period that we think of, about 1838, one of the great vocalists, singers, I believe from Austria, had come to America, and he was singing a special concert for the House of Representatives in the Senate. And about halfway through, I mean, it was just magnificent, a Western congressman from Kentucky stood up and he hollered, "Enough of that, you know, let's have Hail to Columbia and High on the Tenors." And I think that does reflect something about this American idea of identity and what music should be and what it is. There's the great story that supposedly a Confederate officer who was captured said to the Union commander, he said, "You know, if we'd have had your music, we'd have won this war." Music is so important. It says so much. Robert E. Lee said you couldn't have an army without the music.
Wow.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah.
Music. Literally?
Yes. I mean, each unit had a regimental band that provided support for their troops in terms of emotion support. The bands provided a mechanism for recruitment. You think about it. How do you get people's attention when you need to draw soldiers to come and sign on the dotted line? You have the band play a jaunty tune or two at that point when
stir
people
you
come.
Up.
Yes, and then play some sentimental tunes. Get the patriotism rolling. At that point, then hit them up, you know, sign up. Earn yourself
right.
a decent wage and forces.
And you know, Scott, people talk about Lincoln's melancholy, but you listen to the music of the era, and it may have been a melancholy age for a lot of people, a lot of the music that way. I do a sort of tongue-in-cheek lecture about, you know, all the serious historians love to debate things about why the North won the Civil War and the Confederacy lost. And one of the things I do is I just have students sing part of the song Dixie, and convincing part of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And you have this sort of a stirring marching song versus slow, nostalgic song. And so think about it. I say to them, which would you rather charge into battle singing, let us die to make men free, versus look away, Dixieland? There's so much in the music that you can play off of and do with. And Julia Ward Howe, you know, who comes up with the Battle Hymn of the Republic, she actually, I like to say, changed her tune. And after the war, when she realized all the killing this entailed that goes with any war, particularly with the Civil War, when so many Americans died, when you look at the proportion of the population, it's just huge. Dying to make men free became killing to make men free, and she rebelled against that. She became a leader of the women's peace movement after the war. So there's so much that the music tells us, or at least hints at. I think you have to be careful with it, but hints at about what the culture and what the people thought of themselves or wanted to be, and how it reflects throughout the society.
Yeah, we already have a listener who would like to join us this afternoon, so let's go and take this call now. A listener in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, this is a great topic, and so far very interesting. And Professor Burton's last comments were actually directly related to what I wanted to ask about, which is I once heard somewhere that both Lincoln and Jefferson Davis had used the song Dixie in their campaigns. I don't know if that is really true, and I wonder if either of you could sort of talk to that. And also, you just led me to think about the fact about when did Dixie, which as I understand it was originally written in the North, become so associated with the South and with the Confederacy? And I guess I'll probably just hang up and listen over
okay.
the air.
Thanks for your question. Great one.
That's that is an excellent question. 1859 is the time that we associate with Dan Emmett's creation of Dixie and the Bonnie Blue Flag being kind of the next iteration. Those, in essence, weren't necessarily Southern tunes at the beginning, but in essence, what kind of commandeered in some effect by the South. What is striking is that Dixie, we associate with the South and the Confederacy, was a favorite tune of Lincoln's. And he would often, if he heard it once, ask for it to be repeated again. It's a happy, jaunty tune that, as Vernon indicated, was something that would stir the spirits up, you know, get you excited as quite frankly, if you needed to charge into battle, that was the tune that you'd want to be singing as opposed to the Battle of the Hymn. Vernon, what are your thoughts?
Well, I reverse that. I think I'd rather sing Battle Hymn of Republic to charge into battle and sort of do it the other way, sort of a nostalgic look away. But I think you're right. Dan Emmett is, I think, is very interesting because I'm working on an article with a graduate student on nationalism. And here you have what becomes sort of the national anthem of the Confederacy, written by a Yankee for a minstrel show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the minstrel shows were often black-faced. I mean, it says a lot about culture, but Lincoln's loving this song. He was just part of America. All Americans learned. So after Lincoln visited Richmond, Virginia, when the Union forces won that city, but before the end of the Civil War, he requested the military band play two songs. He asked the band to play the Marseillaise to honor the guest from France, the Marquis de Chambrun. Then asking the band to play Dixie, said it was, and I think this is an exact quote, "good to show the rebels that with us in power they would be free to hear it again." And there's another time that he says something similar, but he says to show that this is our song as well and belongs to us as well. So, again, you sort of see both sides. And, of course, in the age of Lincoln, I would argue very strongly that it is Lincoln's Southern heritage and culture that sort of is crucial to understanding him, and that would also help explain the identity with Dixie. We must remember that this area of Illinois, Southern Illinois, Southern Indiana, Southern Ohio, certain Missouri, it was settled by Southern immigrants. I mean, they really were. There were, as I've argued, two groups who came in. One group, like the Lincolns and his family, hated slavery and wanted to get away from it. But another group came in who wanted to get away from African Americans. I mean, very racist, and it settled. So Springfield, Illinois was originally named Calhoun for John C. Calhoun. So you get a sense of the Southern roots of so many of these people who went on to fight for the Union in the Civil War.
You mentioned African-Americans. You also mentioned minstrel shows, Vernon. And I'm wondering, what were the contributions? What was going on here? Give us some context, some background in terms of what they were contributing, what African-Americans were contributing to the music of this period. Were they involved with the popular music of the day for the white culture?
Well, in many ways. In fact, Scott can probably answer this better than I can. There's a whole history of, was it Stephen Foster who's listening in the background while an African-American is singing Jump Jim Crow?
Yep, that's it exactly.
And you can probably do a better job. I have the historian's tape, but maybe between the two of us we can get some aspect of American culture. You know, you can go all the way back to the idea of the sort of blues and their origins and the gospel music, whether it was the hill country whites or African Americans and their version, how that all emerges. You can trace it all the way down to current day music and certainly rock and roll. And the origins is always somewhat obscure because it's an imprecise, I wouldn't say science, but I guess it is a science of tracing origins of music. But it was extraordinary, everything from the banjo to the music itself, and certainly the way that African Americans sung the gospel songs, the way that, in fact, it becomes a that you hear today with the great speeches that people play with Martin Luther King Jr., the call and response pattern, even though the words might even be the same. They can have different meanings and used in different ways. Now, Scott, you probably know this as a musicologist much better than I, but is that a fair?
I would say yes. In many respects, we have music traditions that are, in essence, commandeered and adapted to fit the tastes of American populations in such a way that it's almost a blending. It's not an exact, you know, carryover from one culture to the next. And so you have this, you know, for Stephen Foster, taking what he hears and views as the best qualities of the African culture, African-American culture in terms of music, and then writes those pieces for, in essence, a white audience. And from there, kind of bringing their music into the homes, the parlors, that at the time would not have been possible if someone of African-American descent were to walk into a house and sing a tune. I mean, that wouldn't have been possible. But to have that music brought in on sheet music and played at the piano or sung as a group with guitar and banjo, I mean, immediately bringing these cultures together in a way that I don't think people really quite grasp the impact initially.
Yeah, and I think even today it's not appreciated in terms of popularizing a certain kind of music.
I would agree. I mean, it's interesting. We get back to the, you know, the whole idea of a sentimentality. It's, you know, there are two bents. I mean, the Lincoln and the nation as a whole love songs of this time that allow them to express for themselves, from the first person identity, their sense of patriotism, love, loss. If we go to the South, and you know, the tune "Lorena," very popular tune in the South, written by what I believe to be J.P. Webster in 1856, and yeah, became a popular tune because it talked about home, leaving home, loneliness. It was so popular and so moving that if you had a bad day on the battlefield, it made you so homesick you just left. And that created problems for both the North and South because it was a tune that became so popular across both the North and South that the soldiers, you know, it was the kind of song they didn't want you to sing.
That's
so
right.
Much so they banned it.
One of the most interesting things is both on the eve of the Battle of Stones River in December 1862, the Union and Confederate bands began playing Home Sweet Home in unison. Soldiers both sides sang along. It was almost like the famous Christmas truce in December 1914 during the first year of World War One, and it really, I almost break up and cry when I start thinking about these young boys, so many of them were out killing one another, and this longing for home and what they thought it was all about. Even the origins of Taps comes out of the Civil War, and I mean, there's so much you can do with this era of the, and can be done, and people are starting to do it. It's one of the things I'm excited about, what Scott's doing, others, is that we as historians can learn so much from the work they're doing now on music.
Well, it does reflect a different take on, for example, Lincoln. We know him through his speeches, his acts as a president, and now beginning to capture what I think is kind of the more truer view of the humanity of Lincoln through the arts, the music that he surrounded himself with or called upon in moments of need. So you begin to get a different perspective on the man himself.
And, of course, Lincoln, we forget, actually was a musician. That is, he played a mouth organ called by various names. A little, I don't know what the exact technical, what's the technical name of it? It's not a harmonica when you hold the mouth.
Well, basically, Jaws harp.
I guess Jaws harp would be better, but was certainly, when I grew up, it was used in the South with an anti-Semitic, I think it could be, construed term.
Right.
And Lincoln actually called it that himself. I mean, Lincoln used words that are probably inappropriate today, but in his time were rather common.
Well, it's interesting. I guess, you know, playing the Jaws harp, is a more rhythmic instrument than we think of as melodic. He and Mrs. Lincoln really couldn't read music, and there are stories of him as who would join in singing. This is particularly when he was younger, and given the stories that, you know, he was quickly asked not to sing. So I suspect while he loved music, I don't think he had a particularly, you know, a natural ability with the
I certainly identify with that as opposed to his height.
You know, one of the things that surprised me as I was preparing for this conversation that we're having here this afternoon is that this surprised me. Lincoln was a fan of opera well, not just the popular tunes of the day.
The culture and the arts, greatly loved. And, you know, I want to say one other thing along the line about music. You know, Lincoln was a poet. He wrote poetry.
Well,
and you can laugh at it as not being very good, but when we put our own hand to it, would it be any better? I mean, here was a man who liked expressing himself in the arts and appreciated the arts expression to him.
Given his talent with language, did he ever pen a lyric or two?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, some of the poems, you know, as all poems could be, some of the could be set to a little bit of rhythm, I suspect. I don't know if they were or not, but given the sort of rural culture he came out of and my own reading of rural culture, I'm standing here on very shaky ground, but it could have easily been sung as well as said, as a particular the little limerick-like poems.
Well, he clearly liked limericks. There's no question about that. And I think that would probably come the closest to a musical iteration of a particular poem.
Yeah.
But nothing actually written and performed like a piece of music as we would associate it with.
What's great, though, is to hear, you know, Copeland Sweet and some of the others now, as they've put Lincoln's words to music, like the Gettysburg Address. You hear, you know, so it's almost music itself is such great language.
Well, one of the things, I find interesting is, you know, he, as president, took time out 19 times to see grand opera. Verdi's Masked Ball, Mozart's Magic Flute, Bellini's Norma, even Weber's Freischutz. I mean, these are all being written at the time. Of course, they're sung, performed in English. So moved by Gounod's Faust, in particularly the Soldier's Chorus, that, that Soldier's Chorus was, he had immediate connection to in terms of, the battlefield experience and the whole fact of the home, drawn in and, a wish to go home after the battle's done. So, I mean, clearly the opera connection is quite striking from the stories, the emotions associated with that and the grand spectacle of the stage.
And there we're going to put things on pause for just a moment. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We are going to continue our discussion about Lincoln and his age through the lens of music this afternoon with Scott Schwartz and Vernon Burton in just a moment. But we need to pause here because this is our fall membership period. It's a very important time for us. In many organizations, there's usually a core group of supporters who continue to give. And they give a lot, while many others assume that doing nothing won't hurt anything. But not every member renews their support each year. So for any group to be healthy, to survive, to thrive, new members need to step in and keep us going. Today's the day you can step in. Give us a call. Pledge your financial support. The number 217-244-9455 and tell us you want to become a new member. Your gift of support at whatever level you can afford is all it takes. 217-244-9455. And back to Martha Deal. She's been my partner this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, helping me ask for your support.
Well, and it's a pleasure to do that because I heartily approve of the programming that we bring to our listeners. And I'm asking you to go online, and it's a secure website, makewillpledge.org. Do you know that a contribution of $120 will allow you to choose a one-year subscription to The New Yorker as a thank you gift? And probably a lot of people are out there who are familiar with what The New Yorker is. It brings you a mixture of culture, art, politics, design, technology, and more. And a $120 contribution will give you a one-year subscription. Join the growing number of listeners who support the service that matters to them. Make your contribution now at willpledge.org.
We use the contributions of our friends, our members, along with business and foundation support to give you hour after hour of news, information, and conversations like the one we're having here this afternoon. We think it works quite well. So during our fundraising drive, we're asking you to make a contribution to keep all of this coming your way. Call 217-244-9455 now with that pledge of support.
And don't think of it as $120. Think of it as $10 a month that helps pay for all the news and information you hear on AM 580. Call 217-244-9455 or log on at willpledge.org and make your contribution today.
Okay, now let's get back to the programming, the important stuff. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and this afternoon on the program, we're talking about Lincoln and his age through the lens of music. Two guests are with us this afternoon. They are historian Vernon Burton. He's on the phone with us. He is, by the way, the author of a number of books, including The Age of Lincoln. With me in the studio, Scott Schwartz of the Center for American Music at the University of Illinois. The impetus for this interview, the Center's 2008 musical celebration, and part of the celebration is going to center around Lincoln and his music, melodies that moved the man and the nation. And Vernon Burton will be taking part in the celebration. He's going to present a talk, Lincoln's America, at Alice Campbell Alumni Center, November 22nd at 10:30. Maybe, Scott, you'd tell us a little bit about this event, and if people are interested, how do they make sure that they are ready and able to attend?
Well, that's great. The November 22nd is really going to be a busy day. Vernon kicks off with his lecture in the morning on Lincoln's America, and then we have a book signing and a luncheon. It gives an opportunity for people to talk to Vernon. In the afternoon, we have two presentations about dance and music from barn to ballroom, celebrating Lincoln's love of music and dance. That will be basically a presentation by Paul Tyler, who will talk about barn dance traditions in mid-19th century. And then Deborah Hyland, who we call the dance mistress of the 20th and 21st century, who will talk about the traditions of the ballroom, particularly, how ladies use the fan to kind of tell the beau, I got a green light or a red light. And that evening, we will then have a grand ball, costume ball. We have a Civil War band coming in from Springfield who will play tunes of Lincoln's time. And we will start out the event in grand style as a ball. And halfway through, then we'll let the ladies drop the hoops. And then we'll do a barn dance and really kind of cover the other side of the tracks in terms of the music that Lincoln was so fond of and enjoyed dancing.
Yeah, well, now let's go from the ballroom to the tavern. What kind of music was in the taverns of the time?
Your Irish jigs, your reels, much of the imported music from Europe, jaunty tunes. If we were thinking of a folk tradition, the parlor music, quite frankly, many more of those Irish tunes kind of turned into piano licks, tunes, and maybe in some instances adding words or changing the words.
Yeah. Well, here's something interesting as well. I just learned this just recently, that a drinking song could be turned into something of a higher order, if I could put it that way. And I think what we want to do here is maybe play a tune called Lincoln and Liberty.
Oh, that'd be a great one.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
Okay, here we go.
Hurrah for the choice of the nation, our chieftain so brave and so true. We'll go for the great reformation, for Lincoln and liberty too.
We'll go for the son of Kentucky, our hero of Hoosierdom through. For the people are everywhere calling, for Lincoln and liberty too. Fight till our banner's victorious, for Lincoln and liberty too.
Come all you true friends of the nation, attend to humanity's call. Come aid in the slave's liberation, and roll on the liberty ball.
And roll on the liberty ball. Come aid in the slave's liberation and roll on the liberty ball.
That's a tune called Lincoln and Liberty, and this was a reincarnated tune. What was its first incarnation?
The tune itself starts out as Rosin the Bow. It's an Irish jig. I'm not quite clear who created it, but it's basically a drinking song. And if we were to look at the original words to it before it's changed, it starts out with, I've traveled all over the world and now to another I go. And I know that good quarters are waiting to welcome old Rosin the Bow, to welcome old Rosin the Bow, to welcome old Rosin the Bow. And I know that good quarters are waiting to welcome old Rosin the Bow. So that very standard Irish jig. And in 1860, Jesse Hutchinson, part of the Hutchinson family, rewrote the words for this to assist with the first election campaign of Lincoln in 1860.
And you might tell them who Joseph Hutchinson and the Hutchinson family were, and maybe their music did as much. I mean, we talk about who freed the slaves, whether it is debate, whether it were the slaves and slave people themselves, or whether it was Abraham Lincoln, or was it the army? And I think a lot of credit's got to go to people like the Hutchinson family, these abolitionist singers.
Oh, definitely.
That really stirred the souls of the nation about slavery and enslavement and what it meant.
The Hutchinson family come from New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically debut as a musical ensemble in the 1840s. And what's striking is that they consider themselves reformers, not entertainers. Tunes, you know, they focused on the evils of drink and come up with tunes like King Alcohol and Cold Water. Slavery with such tunes as Bereaved Slave Mother and Gone, Sold, Gone. And abolition, Get Off the Track and John Brown's Body, just to kind of give a sense of, you know, just the kinds of tunes. And many of them were old tunes with new lyrics. In some instances, actually new tunes and words, but for the most part, reworkings.
Yeah, Vernon, I understand that this tune, Lincoln and Liberty, was a significant factor in the election. Can you give us some background there?
Well, I think it probably could, but let me back up when it's Liberty and Lincoln. You know, my interpretation in the Age of Lincoln revolves around arguments about freedom. And I think one thing we have to understand is that freedom meant different things to different people at that time. That's why people could listen to the same words in a song and have different meanings. But one scholar discovered by 1860 there were 200 different definitions of liberty and freedom. And if you just think about it, what freedom meant to an enslaved person on a Louisiana plantation versus a young 14-year-old girl sewing soles on shoes in a New England shoe factory versus a yeoman farmer out on the Illinois frontier all meant different things. So liberty was featured in many of the songs of the war. The proposed Confederate national anthem, which was penned by St. George Tucker early in the war and sung to the tune of none other than the Star-Spangled Banner, suggests that Northern tyranny was crushing liberty. One of the most famous Civil War tunes, the Battle Cry of Freedom, stirred both Northern and Southern soldiers. Southern soldiers liked it. They changed the words, and they had the same song. Jim McPherson, one of my PhD advisors, uses that song at the beginning of his book to show the different versions of the very same song. Composed by the Northerner George Root in 1862, then the song includes the words, "Not a man shall be free." Southern lyricists changed the wording, but not that catchy tune. You get a sense of how liberty goes and the importance of music, and it made me think, of course, We Are Coming, Father Abram, when Lincoln is in trouble and needing reenlistments. You know, a song is written, and We Are Coming 300,000 strong.
Hmm. To my mind, music today is a little bit in the background when it comes to politics. Am I right, or am I dead wrong?
I don't think I'd agree with you, Scott Chandler, but, you know, it's not the music we might like, but if you listen to these, some of the times, the horrible lyrics of the popular music,
sure,
say in rap,
yeah,
things like this, they're pretty political, I think.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about political campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, we don't. I mean, here we're focused on debates and in some instances, the mudslinging on either party. The tunes, the finesse has largely been lost. I mean, we think about it, you know, elections that have used songs clearly to end liberty themes. You've got, you know, for example, Adams and Liberty, Jefferson and Liberty, Jackson and Liberty. Each, you know, a common theme, different melody, different words. And, you know, the tune here, Lincoln and Liberty, here we have Rosin the Bow, and the tune is used for other elections. You got William Henry Harrison, Henry Clay, and even General Fremont. So, I mean, clearly, you know, music is intricately tied into the fabric of the culture. And I think more so from the point of view of active performance. I mean, people got up and sang. They played these songs at home on the piano. If you heard the tune in an election campaign or a speech, people would suddenly sing it. If we did that today, we would have to force the young kids to unplug the iPods from their ears long enough, and I quite frankly don't know if they'd be up to the task of actually singing.
Well, it's hard for people to believe, but it was amazing how many homes had pianos.
Oh, yeah.
Just extraordinary. And even in Harlem in the 1920s and 30s, people would have rent parties. I mean, this is how late it went, and that was where they'd pay their rent. There'd be pianos in almost all homes, so people could come and you'd find a pianist to play. And I don't know when that culture sort of died out. I certainly had one growing up in 96 South Carolina. But it was something that was part of a home. Families sacrificed for music, singing. It was amazing, you know, singing in church choir was a masculine thing to do. I'm not even sure at some point music came to be seen as much more feminine. I don't know when that happened, but there's some changes in our culture that are pretty amazing.
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily change is, the directions that cultures go for the African-American community and the church and its music. It's still strong. I think if you were to ask them, I don't think they would associate it with a male or femaleness. If we were to answer the question in terms of when kind of music and active participation kind of fall out, maybe one might suggest the Beatles, the beginning of rock and roll from the point of view of we begin to shift away from the participation of family and into kind of ensembles, the garage bands, the bands that I grew up with in the 60s. My folks, as soon as they walked into garage and wanted to join up, it was like, okay, the rehearsal's finished. We're done. That's not cool.
You know, you're talking about music. Can I just suggest one thing? I know we've got a short time. Mm-hmm. My favorite, I just fell in love in working on The Age of Lincoln with Julia Ward Howe, an amazing woman, just extraordinary person. But, you know, she was a New England social activist, and she took, we mentioned John Brown's Body. She actually took that song that people were singing, mixed the tune of John Brown Bodies with new words, become more grand and terrible, actually, urging Americans to, quote, die to make men free. And then she gave the example of John Brown and Christ both, and how sort of immensely, I think, self-satisfied at the time. I've already mentioned how she changes her mind. Battle Hymn of the Republic offered a real prophecy to a grieving, bewildered people. Confederate defeat meant the coming of the Lord itself, she promised, the advent of God's truth, that is his truth, into a sinful nation redeemed by faith, grace, and blood. And that's an example to me of the music telling the story, perhaps, even before the war is concluded, of what this war is going to have meaning about, the importance of music, and how it's adapted from one song to another. And I don't find it inconsequential that it's a woman who's doing it.
In one place to another.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
The song, you know, even when I grew up in the South, that was not a song. People wanted to hear a song. There's a famous story of Souser. I'm sure you know more about it than I do. It was in Georgia playing the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
I don't know that story at the top of my head right now, but I know, you have to remember, if we talking about Souser, I mean, you look at him as a child growing up in Washington, D.C., his father, he plays trombone in the Marine Band. He's well aware. He can hear the cannons fire. I mean, he knows and has watched the soldiers come back, battle-worn. What's kind of striking is that if we look at him later in 1891, while he's director of the Marine Band, he writes a piece called Sheridan's Ride based on the Battle of Cedar Creek of 1864. And he actually tries to capture in many ways the sights and sounds of that particular battle and his experiences as a child growing up in a time of war. So, a different perspective on, Sousa's take.
Two things we haven't explored, and it's fascinated me, and I haven't made up my mind, Scott, and that is when I told a little bit of the story about 1838 and the singing for Congress, is this search for two things. One is celebrating the American individualism, and so many of the songs are a search or an assertion of community, even based upon community, particularly true in African-American music, but I think also true in a lot of the sort of rural white music that comes out, a creation of community out of these belief in individualism, almost contradictory terms.
Not really. I mean, in essence, it was an age of having the opportunity to express oneself and one's own feelings as opposed to singing about someone else's experience, which, you know, in the early 19th century was kind of the way to do things. Mm-hmm. You were almost removed from the musical experience. And now we have an opportunity to actually express our own personal feelings through song and words. And it opened up a whole sense of it's not about you, it's about us.
Hmm. One last thing here. We have to wrap up. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask Vernon Burton what he thinks about this. You know, I read a story in preparation for this program about Lincoln asking someone who was, I don't know if it was a staff, was someone on his staff or a companion, but he asked this gentleman at various times, he would ask him, sing one of the little sad songs. And apparently it was of great comfort to Lincoln, and this was such a time of upheaval. You know, one wonders what would have been on Lincoln's mind as he took the oath of office and then through the days of this horrible war. Vernon, you want to just give us a minute here on that?
Well, I talked earlier about there's much made of Lincoln's melancholy, but mm-hmm. if you listen to the music, so much of the music about love lost or lost loves and things is a melancholy music, don't you think, Scott? It's not just Lincoln that way. But Lincoln had also people have to remember, lost his beloved children in this war, some of his best friends early on. So it was a very personal thing for him. One of the great ironies for me about Lincoln that I think has never been explored as it should, Lincoln's hero was Henry Clay, the great compromiser. As Lincoln once told someone, you know, here he was who could hardly kill a fly or mosquito, and all the suffering and all the death that was, you know, wrought because of him as president. So I think all that weighed heavy upon Lincoln. He thought he had a soft heart, but he was tough enough to see through what he believed in.
There we are going to wrap things up this afternoon, although I do want Scott to tell us a little bit about where we can find information about the 2008 music celebration of the Center for American Music at the University of Illinois, which also involves the entire community.
If you go to the if you just type in SUSE Archives and from the front door, just click to American Music Month 2008, it will take you a link to not only a description of what we're doing for this year, but in a link to the events calendar covering, you know, a whole gambit of stuff for the entire month of November and into December.
Okay. Musicologist Scott Schwartz, thank you very much. Historian Vernon Burton, thank you.
Thank you very much. And Scott, I'm eager to hear more from you.
Oh, I look forward to talking to you in November, definitely.
Okay. Vernon Burton will be taking part in the celebration of Lincoln and his music. He'll present a talk, Lincoln's America, at Alice Campbell Alumni Center on November 22nd at 10:30. And let me mention also that Vernon Burton's most recent book is The Age of Lincoln. It was published in 2007 by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and it is now in paperback through Hill & Wang.